Good evening, and welcome to Night Gallery.
Thank you, Rod. And I want to welcome everyone to Midnight Viewing, where once a month we talk all about your follow-up to The Twilight Zone, Rod Serling's Night Gallery.
They say it's Rod Serling's Night Gallery, and it isn't really Rod Serling's Night Gallery. It's somebody else's.
Oh, we know. We talk about it a lot. Your curators at Midnight Viewing are the projection booth's Mike White.
What can happen to human beings when trust is wiped out by suspicion?
And CultureCast's Chris Stashew.
Small boy encased in a crystal ball.
And I'm Father Malone.
The kind of thing that usually infests nightmares.
Join us monthly at Midnight Viewing, the Night Gallery podcast at WeirdingWayMedia.com.
Doesn't remotely belong to me. I have no proprietary interest in that at all.
I'm Chris Stash.
I'm Mike White.
And this is Father Malone.
And we are the hosts of Dreams for Sale, a monthly look at The Twilight Zone 1985, as Father Malone would say, the only reboot worth watching.
Goddamn right.
The only one that doesn't use ham-fisted racial ideas to beat us over the head and make us all feel uncomfortable. On this episode of Dreams for Sale, we're going to be taking a look at the 10th episode of the reboot. That episode is split into three segments. The Shadow Man, the episode we have been waiting to talk about since essentially we started this podcast. We're going to have an interview with Rockne O'Bannon after we talk about that episode. We're also going to be talking about The Uncle Devil Show, which is a like 5-minute segment, and Opening Day, the final segment, which is directed by John Milius.
When you're 13 years old, you're supposed to be beyond those childhood fears of things that go bump in the night. Supposed to be. But for Danny Hayes, those fears are about to rear up before him from the shadows of the Twilight Zone.
So The Shadow Man aired with the rest of the segments on November 29th, 1985. It is written by Rockne S. O'Bannon and directed by Joe Dante. It stars Jonathan Ward as an awkward young man who ends up using a Shadow Man to get back at the people that torment him. And it is pretty good. And the twist at the end is pretty great as well. But I'm sure you guys have a lot more to say about it than I do, because you two have been fawning over getting a chance to talk about this episode since we started the podcast.
Yeah, apparently this episode really made an impression. Because I can remember just about everything. This aired November 29th, 1985. Maybe I was, just enjoying my Thanksgiving break or something. But my God, this really, it put a dent in me. I don't remember the others on this episode very much at all, but I sure do remember The Shadow Man.
I am 100% there with you. This is, I had been watching the show since it came back on, but this is the one that really freaked me the fuck out and has stayed with me for, 37, 34 years, something like that since then. I remember every single aspect of it. I could quote it endlessly. If anyone ever asks me about the Twilight Zone 85, this is the one I bring up immediately. There's something so absolutely potent about the storyline and just almost everything about it. I mean, looking back on it now, I've got a few quibbles, but they are quibbles nonetheless. And the twist at the end is fucking great. I don't know. I'm just going to fawn over this entire thing because I think it's just awesome.
What do you think, Chris?
I thought it was fun. I thought it was interesting. I think Rockne O'Bannon knows how to write an episode. Was that documentary called The Nightmare, directed by the gentleman?
Yeah, I've seen that.
The gentleman whose name escapes me, who directed Room 237.
Oh, Rod Asher.
Rod Asher, yeah. There's a segment in The Nightmare that looks just like The Shadow Man, and I had kind of forgotten about it when we talked to Rockne O'Bannon, and I wanted to ask him about it, but I can't think that those are coincidence. because it is identical down to the kind of the black fedora, it's not really a fedora, but like the black hat, and you know, the shadowy aspect of the character where you can't see him at all, not even an outline of his face, just the outline of his body. But I think it's an interesting concept, and they do a good job of kind of establishing a set of rules within the episode very quickly that they stick to, and then they subvert right at the end. And I liked that a lot, and I think that this is one of the better segments we've seen. But I don't think I'm speaking, illogically in that respect.
Yeah, Rock O'Bannon just seems to be one of, if not the only writer on the show who really understands that we'll go with whatever they give us as long as it's interesting, and we don't need to know anything more about the Shadow Man than what we're given. Just sort of throws us in. Here it is. Now fucking deal with it. And I always loved that about the episode. And, you know, that what more potent fear does a child have than the concept of something living under his bed? And the way it's handled here, where this nightmare creature comes shambling out from underneath his bed every night, but has assured him that you don't have to worry, I'm not going to hurt you, is such a great idea. And how emboldening for this particular character, who ends up being kind of an asshole by the end and kind of gets what he deserves in a way. Almost a little too, that's my one quibble with it, having rewatched it now. There's a line where, like, sort of halfway through the episode, where he's dealing with one of his only friends, if not his only friend, where he's like, I'm, you know, shrugging you off for my new friends now, like, which I felt wasn't really necessary. We could already see that he had drifted and was becoming kind of a jerk on his own. Other than that, there's a lot to like in the episode, particularly, and this is both writing and directing. After the first few people have been attacked by the Shadow Man, there's just a shot through this diner where we go from booth to booth, and each of the kids are explaining a little bit more about what we're hearing. I thought that was really sort of masterfully done.
I was reminded, too, a little bit of, like, you were talking, Chris, about the nightmare, and I was reminded a little bit of the Slender Man because of the way that they were talking about how tall and thin this guy is. And I don't even know if they mentioned the hat, but I was like, oh, okay, I guess it's this kind of, the Jungian trope of this, shadowy figure that's going to go around and murder kids. And I love that they're just like, oh, yeah, he's murdering kids, so don't go out after dark and stay home and, you know, eat your Ovaltine, those kind of things.
But, is he murdering them, though?
That's what it seems like. He's either murdering them or kidnapping them.
Well, he's fucking them up.
Yeah, he's just fucking them up because they said they're in the hospital. If it had been him murdering the kids, I mean, this would have been probably the best thing I've seen. Because
I guess that's just wish fulfillment on my part.
Right. Well, I mean, look, I mean,
all of our parts.
That would be the best route to go here, right? Because then you really do understand that Danny gets what he deserves at the end. Because if he's killing other kids,
in the original script, I wonder if it, there was a sort of standards and practices thing there. They were like, well, you can't have him murdering them. Maybe he's just beating them up. You know, that all feels like a concession.
Yeah, it kind of does.
I thought he was beating them up. I always thought that it was murder. So that's so funny.
Yeah, because it says they're in the hospital now. That's one of the first lines. As soon as they come back from the first night, it's so-and-so's in the hospital. But yeah, no, take that line away. And my assumption is just the same as yours, Mike, which is he's just fucking killing kids. Which, again, not to be, bombastic, but that would have been a much better outcome for this episode, because then you really do feel like Danny gets what he deserves. At the end, then he's just going to get beaten up by the Shadow Man, as opposed to murdered, which would be a much, much more kind of interesting outcome for his character.
I think we all know that he was about to die, right? I mean,
Again, if everything else is they're getting beaten up,
Yes, but this is a different Shadow Man.
Right. Very true. It could be that the Shadow Man under someone else's bed murders kids.
I mean, this episode has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's all told in just a few minutes, and it is just telegraphed so wonderfully that it's like, I don't need him freaking out and going absolutely batshit crazy when the Shadow Man comes out. I don't need him looking under the bed and finding a doorway into some mystical land like Monsters, Inc. or something. Just, it's simple, it's direct, it gets there, and it gets there efficiently.
Yeah, and again, it is really the way that they do the twist, I really appreciated it as well. Because Yeah, it doesn't feel ridiculous. It feels, oh, that's someone else's Shadow Man. Uh-oh, what now? And it really works, and I like it a lot. I think it's a really well-done twist.
And Mike, I don't know if you felt this way, but this certainly when I saw an episode like this or something like Wordplay, or I know I'm just naming Rock Neobanon episodes now, but when this show works as it should, it felt like at the time, like they were doing it not correctly, but it felt like it was an actual Twilight Zone for us, as opposed to like all the reruns we had been watching forever. Like that might have been appropriate in 1962 for those kids who were watching it, but when an episode like this came on, it really felt like they were speaking to us in our generation. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, there were times where I was confusing this with Tales from the Dark Side, which I always felt like the hipper cousin of the reboot of Twilight Zone. I don't know
if
you felt that way, but it just it had a harder edge to it. And this was one of the episodes that really had a hard edge to it, even though it's not that hard. But it's still just like, wow, yeah, this is pretty intense.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there about Tales from the Dark Side. Then it always did feel like they were going a little harder. And Twilight Zone always felt a little more slick, just production wise. Rarely did they the two sort of overlap in a way that felt gratifying and wonderful. And this particular thing, like, I mean, you know, look, we've been talking about this since we started this podcast about doing this particular one. It's one of the best segments ever on the show, beginning to end.
Totally agree.
Yeah, I would agree as well. I mean, again, we've seen a lot of good segments. We've seen a handful, now I would say three or four great segments, and a lot of mediocre to bad segments, and this is up there with the great segments for sure.
Yeah. I mean, you were right on, Father Malone, talking about Wordplay, because that's the other one that comes to mind. I mean, Shatterday, Wordplay, and this one are the ones that so far have really stood out for me, where I'm like, yeah, this is why I want to watch this show.
Yeah, they just continue to resonate in a way that most of the other segments don't. It doesn't feel like they were trying to ape the original Twilight Zone. It felt like it was a new and sort of fresh take on what the Twilight Zone should be of that time. And like the original Twilight Zones, the ones that we remember still resonate today because they have like a timeless nature to it. This one sort of taps into fears and primal feelings that people have that, you know, I mean, clearly this is 1985 just from the look and the fashion of it and everything, but nevertheless, like, what a fucking powerhouse of an episode.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I mean, it's the best thing we've seen in what, five episodes at least.
You could have put Dead Woman's Shoes and Wong's Emporium after this one, and I would still say, watch that episode. It's a great fucking episode.
Yeah, you're not wrong. I would agree with that 100%.
But what about Ye Gods? Come on.
Ooh. I'm not sure.
Throw that in there, too.
Oh, wow.
What about Witch Bank?
Oh, okay, come on now.
Actually, I do have to take a bit. The other one that works for me is Dealer's Choice. I think that has to be the last great one that we saw.
Yeah, Dealer's Choice.
Speaking of which, the next segment is actually written by the same writer.
Exactly, yeah. Donald Todd. Donald.
So before we get... Oh, my God. So before we get to that next segment, we'll play our interview with Rockney O'Bannon, and then we'll talk about the next segment, The Uncle Devil Show.
Obviously, you got involved with the show with your script for Wordplay. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
And now, I mean, I watched the DVD commentary, and like Harlan Ellison just could not stop praising you. And I'm actually sort of a two-part question. Like, is that how you got involved? And what was your relationship with Harlan Ellison? Like, I'm actually a huge fan of both of you. And with his recent passing, which is tragic, I'd like to know about his involvement on the series as well.
Yeah. It began with Wordplay. I was writing, as all, you know, beginning writers do. I was writing spec everything. I was writing spec features. I was writing spec episodes of other TV shows that were on at the time. And there was a show that was on, I think it was ABC, a couple years before the new Twilight Zone came along, called Dark Room, and it was very similar to Twilight Zone, and it had
James Coburn was the host of that.
Exactly, and it was like Night Gallery, sort of, you know, but with more Twilight Zone like stories. And so I wrote a wordplay and then another short, a half hour piece for that, and I actually managed to get the scripts into the producers of the show. They're very complimentary, but they said, the show's already been canceled. So, thanks, but no thanks. And as I like to tell writing classes, the great thing about spec material is it never dissolves. It always survives on your hard drive. So I just held on to these little half hour scripts that really would have no value otherwise. And then lo and behold, along came both Twilight Zone and Amazing Stories, which was the Spielberg, version of kind of a Twilight Zone, and was able to submit the scripts to both of them and got very good response to this script's wordplay in particular from both shows. But then Twilight Zone had me in right away and put me on staff, which was stunning to me because I would have been thrilled to work on any crappy Universal hour show. So wordplay was the first thing I went in, and I was a huge fan of Harlan Ellison, obviously, before learning he was going to work on the show. And he wrote, which I have framed, a little paragraph before he ever met me, a little paragraph review of wordplay. He was commenting on all the material that was coming in. Mm-hmm. Incredibly, generous and Harlan, was nothing if not incredibly, opinionated and evocative in writing. So if he likes something, he really likes it. If he really hates something, he really hates it. So it was like I benefited. I was on the positive side of that ledger.
A good place to be.
It was awesome to me to get this, from Harlan, because I had in high school I'd read. He did I think it was for the LA Weekly, a regular column called The Glass Teat. It was then collected about television. I haven't read it in literally decades, but it's something people should seek out and look at. It certainly is a window onto, I guess 60s and early 70s television from the amazing point of view of Harlan Ellison. But anyway, so I was a big fan of that. So. The fact that I had, Harlan, being as kindly praiseworthy as he was just stunning to me. And Harlan was great. He was, as was everybody on this staff. I mean, it was a very writer-centric staff, and I was the new kid. And, you could not be greener than I was, So I think everybody took a lot of, we're very, patient with me and generous with me, and Harlan very much among them. And there's nothing quite like being able to hang out with Harlan Ellison,
I bet.
And, up at his house and just, all of the above. So, just a fabulous, introduction to the business they say Harlan, along with Phil Daguerre and Alan Brennard and Jim Crocker, who would, the other, made up the rest of the staff that first season, first half of the first season. It was just a fabulous, entree into the biz.
Yeah. I've been hearing that it was, everyone who interview I've read has said it was a very writer show, which is rare, I guess, for television. But, I'm wondering, just in the sort of nuts and bolts of it, can you say, now you guys were in L.A. writing it, and I believe the show at the time was shot in Los Angeles, right?
Yes, at the CBS lot in Studio City. So,
okay.
Yeah,
so you guys were right there.
Never have. We shot on the lot right there.
As a writer, were you able to, actually be on the set and see what was going on, or was it something that, you didn't feel comfortable with, or?
No, that was the other, yet another aspect of why this was a fabulous job. For a writer on staff was because Phil Daguerre, who is the showrunner, and major, guru of the series, our version of the series, was incredibly inclusive. So we writers kind of produced our own episodes, not that the producers, Harvey Fran was the line producer, and Jim Crocker was the supervising producer, was kind of the most in charge. But we got to follow our episodes all the way through. So we were involved with casting. We were involved with, you know, meetings with the directors and on set, you know, all the time. So in terms of learning the nuts and bolts of television, yeah, it was an outstanding experience. You know, just again, for a first job where I would have been thrilled to have just sold a, you know, a single standalone episode as a freelancer to, trying to think of what show was on around the same, you know, like Magnum PI or something, you know, the original Magnum PI.
Yes, of course. I know. Now they've got a new one. He's Latino now. Can I ask you very quickly about who Stephen Ray is?
Stephen Ray is someone else. It's not me. No.
Not you. Okay.
Stephen Ray was my pseudonym. My mother my mother was a contract dancer at MGM, and she went by the name of Sheila Ray. So Stephen's my middle. Stephen Ray is where it comes from. But it was a pseudonym that I'd chosen and registered with the Writers Guild. And then, many years later, I created a show for the CW called Cult. It was on a few years ago, which was about, it was kind of the inner workings of TV, a kind of a mystery based on, fandom and, you know, fan connections to a TV show. But I wanted to kind of, you know, create a mysterious, unreal creator of that show, of Cult. Uh-huh. And so I used Stephen Ray because I thought it would be great if people went on to IMDb, you know, or I went online and found that Stephen Ray, you know, the creator of Cult, literally had credits going back to the 1980s. so I thought that was kind of awesome. So,
kind of a long-form plan there.
Yeah, no, it was the plan that wasn't planned. But, anytime I can kind of, mess with people's heads, even for a split second, you know, I'll take full advantage of that.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, well, as Stephen Ray, you wrote Miss Fortune Cookie, correct?
Yeah, that was the first script I'd done on staff, and it got rewritten, and it didn't turn out particularly good. And Alan Brennert, who was the other young Turk, he had many more credits than I did at the time because I had zero. But Alan was the other young Turk, and there was something else that he was going to put a pseudonym on. And I said, we kind of made a pact. I said, okay, if you put your pseudonym on that, I'll put mine on this one. So there's no real reason to do it. It was just kind of something to do.
Okay.
And as it turns out, Miss Fortune Cookie is not, you guys will tell me otherwise in a subsequent, episode of your show. But wasn't at the time, it wasn't particularly, poorly regarded. So that's, I just stuck my name on, the pseudonym on it, like I said, for no real reason,
Now, the same season, you wrote The Night of the Meek. Well, you readapted it from the Sterling story, right? That had to be, first of all, daunting, given this is the revival of The Twilight Zone. But I did want to ask you, now, was the episode itself, was it planned to be used from the beginning, or was this sort of in reaction to the whole Knackles episode?
No, Knackles was replaced by Night of the Meek was always going to be part of the Christmas.
Okay.
Episode, and the star was going to be, and then it was, well, I don't recall the, was it, but Can She Type? Was that the other one of that?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. And that one was the replacement for Knackles.
I see.
And if you notice, it's, there's not a lot of Christmas to it. It was an episode by Marty Pascal and Rebecca Parr that was slated to be shot, but then we needed something to replace Knackles, so they threw some Christmas decorations up and made it a Christmas episode. Night of the Meek, look, it was daunting, but it was also, look, I was very young and full of hubris, and you could not find a bigger fan of the original show. So I must preface with that. But I knew it was in CBS's interest to remake some of the original episodes. Just knowing that was our brief, I kind of squared my shoulders and looked at it, and said, okay, what is it that what can I do to maybe contemporize it a bit? And obviously, but also, as a viewer and fan of the show, are there things that now, a couple of decades of distance from the original, are the things that, you know, that I think, you know, might, you know, make it be worth trying. And so I did that one, and I also did the After Hours.
The After Hours, yes.
Yes, I also adapted. And, you know, I found, you know, at least for me, I found things in both of them that I kind of liked as an addition, you know, that I kind of added to the stew. And I think certainly in the matter of the After Hours, there was an opportunity to do things on screen and in camera and such that wasn't available, you know, back in the 60s when they were done originally. So, I was very aware of what I was doing, that I was remaking, you know, Rod Serling. Yeah, I just kind of went for it.
I actually found your episode of the After Hours to be much more menacing. And with Night of the Meek, I got to say, you'll probably disagree with me, but I like it better than the original one.
I'm not going to argue on either of those points. Okay? And I'm not saying I'm agreeing with them, okay? Because I'm not that
right. Just going to no comment.
But, yeah, I'm not arguing with you on either of them. On the After Hours, the one thing that I kind of the intent was to make it more menacing, and that's what I kind of alluded to before. The idea of different ways of portraying the mannequins as not just standing still plastic versions and then the walking around versions, but actually having a big tub full of heads, some of them that open their eyes and speak to you and that sort of thing. And to me, the very fact that she, when she does start to turn into a mannequin, it isn't just all in one go. It's that she literally is turning part by part, so you get to see her reaction to it.
Yeah, and I really like that she didn't, it wasn't like, oh yeah, I'm a mannequin. It was a complete shock to her, which I thought was great.
Yeah. The other thing that they did in the original, which I thought was, again, the great thing about Twilight, the original Twilight Zone, was it really was an original, and you'd never seen anything like these short mm-hmm. things before. So, but they also, in the original After Hours, they kind of put a couple of different fantasy elements into it. So there was, the mannequins would go out, each got their period to go out and walk around and be human, and then they'd have to come back. And then Night of the Meek just had a fantastic performance by Robert Mulligan in the lead. I thought was terrific. And Martha Coolidge, who directed it, best director experience I had, I must say, on the show. I brought her back.
I was going to ask you about that, actually, because I'm a big fan of her work as well. And I actually just watched the episode again last night. And it's wonderfully directed.
She brought out things. I mean, she brought out things that that I didn't expect and such. And she was and is so meticulous about casting. She did an episode for us in, I think it's the second season, called Shelter Skelter, by Ron Cobb and Robin Love. And she cast Joe Mantegna and Joan Allen, neither of whom any of us had ever heard of before. So this is like very, very early in their careers. But she found them and brought them in. Martha's is quite the keeper.
Just a moment ago, we were just saying about how, like, when the original Twilight Zone came out, there had been nothing like it. And we on our podcast have talked about Rod Serling's sort of narration and how necessary it was at the time as just sort of a week in, week out sort of holding the hands of the audience thing. Now, on the revival, there are some episodes that have narration and some don't. Was there a conscious decision, like, before the episode began that you were going to do that or not? I'm just curious about the process there.
Not really. We went through a lot of, there's a lot of discussion about narration. Should there be an on-screen, not on-screen, all of that? Who should it be? Harlan, again, he lobbied strongly for a woman, and I thought that was a fabulous idea. And again, this isn't, he's not suggesting this in 2018. He's suggesting this in 1984, I guess, at that point. So it was very bold, and I thought really, a really interesting idea. And it also, I mean, our other concern was, how do we distinguish it as much as possible from Rod Serling? So we're not attempting to ape him. And, there were suggestions, should we get someone who's a sound-alike for Serling? And that was jettisoned very quickly. But you know, all of the kind of the panoply of possibilities. And when Charles Aidman, who was in my favorite Twilight Zone, if not my favorite from the original series, A Little Girl Lost. Was kind of chosen. That was, to me, was like fantastic. And then in terms of having narration or not narration, I think I would like to think or whatever, because you know, audiences are, by the time our show came around, was very steeped in Twilight Zone type, you know, stories. Narration was probably less necessary, I would think, I hope. But it was just kind of the, you know, in the tradition of the original show, obviously. So, and we were doing a lot of things that were not, the same as the original series in terms of, we were an hour show and with different length episodes within the hour and things like that. So any time we could, find a touchstone with the original, I think, you know, we were happy to do it.
Right. Speaking of, like, Charles Aidman was in one of the original ones, you wrote one of my favorite episodes, Personal Demons. That, now, Martin Balsam was the lead in that, and of course he had been in the original. He was in 16mm Shrine.
Right.
Could you talk about that episode for just a moment? Because, look, not to get too personal real quick, but I was probably 13 when this series was on, and I remember this episode sticking with me. Like, I just thought it was so brilliant. I still do to this day. That we're watching a character, Brockney S. O'Bannon, and then, like, the final credit when he finally starts writing is written by Brockney S. O'Bannon. Like, that's sort of, like, metatextual before it became a thing. Can you tell me anything about that episode?
Yeah, it was not easy to get that one on because it was very strange. It was a very, very strange notion. And for me, it was just this kind of awesome opportunity to attempt to remove the glass between, you know, the TV screen and, you know, the audio, you know, break down the fourth wall, if you will, you know, of that and really give that chill. And I remember Phil Daguerre, as I'm pitching this and I'm trying to figure what's another way to pose this, you know, and he said, I'll let you do it if the guy, the writer, isn't like a young, good looking, not that I was good looking, but a young, you know, positive, good looking guy. He goes, he has to be somehow negative. So I made him into this old has been,
right.
Burnout. And then the minute it was like Martin Balsam, Martin Balsam did everything. And he said everything that's ever been awesome. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This amazing guy. One of my prized possessions, I'm looking at it right now, a picture in my office is me and Martin Balsam, the two Rockney O'Bannons. And then the absolute best part of it is if you go on IMDb and look up Martin Balsam and the roles he's playing.
Oh, it says your name.
It's the best. I can say it. If I do nothing else the rest of my life, that I can die a happy man. So Martin Balsam. But no, you can't even begin to Psycho. You know, a Thousand Clowns.
Right.
You know? Quick Martin Balsam story. So I'm sitting. You know, we did a read through of the scripts and we're just chatting. And I had to ask him, which I think everybody has to ask him, about Psycho. And I said, did you guys know when you were making Psycho? It's such a Bush League question, but I figured I got to ask him.
Right.
So when you were making Psycho, did you have any idea of what a success was going to be? And he goes, no, he goes, you make movies and stuff. And he goes, I know it was Hitchcock, but he goes, you know, you're in the movie, you go up some stairs, they hit you with, you know, they hit you in the head with a wrench, you fall down the stairs, and it's a classic. Now, as a fan, I'm dying because it wasn't a wrench. You know what I mean? Now,
right.
You know, those scenes in Psycho is probably more, as much as any other film, has been analyzed frame by frame by, you know, film historians and students and everything else, you know. And the fact that the guy who's in it, you know, he's like saying,
has no idea.
I think it's like, you know, don't you realize that sequence, you know, people are going, well, no, he was on a, you know, a special tilting chair and the camera, you know, I mean, all of that stuff, and like to him was like, "Hey, hit me in the head with a wrench." I don't know. I just
No, that's great. I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about, or at least ask you about, re-examining the show as we've been, like, certain episodes, resonate a little bit more, wordplay in particular, but, Before I ask anything about that, I do want to ask about probably the episode that stuck with me for 33 years, and that was The Shadow Man. One of the more terrifying episodes of television I had ever seen at the time. Can you tell me anything about that, like where the idea came from or what your experience was with working with Joe Dante? Or
I'm trying to
tell me any and everything.
I wish I remembered it. You write a show, they hit you with a wrench.
Sure.
No, I'm sorry. Okay. I can't for the life of me remember where the idea came from.
Mm.
But again, we were trying as hard as we could generally to do twist ending, because that was what obviously the Twilight Zone was kind of famous for. And it's a really tough thing to do, because when the original Twilight Zone aired, again, twist endings and short stories were you know, pretty commonplace. But certainly on television, that kind of, like, I wasn't expecting that, wasn't that common. And to me, just a general, not even just twist endings, but a general good example of that is Eye of the Beholder in the original series.
Right.
The one, which is... the entire first, you know, other than the last, 1 minute, the entire thing is predicated on us not seeing any of the characters. And
right.
The fact that you could do that and it wouldn't, like, give away the ending, I think to me was a tribute to the fact that audiences were far more, inexperienced in terms of, being set up for a surprise. But here we come, whatever, 20 plus years later, and people watch the old Twilight Zones, and they're very obviously steeped in that kind of, twist ending. So it's much harder to kind of hide it, et cetera. So we were always trying to come up with, when we could, endings, shows with the twist ending. And Shadow Man was kind of, tossing my, my version into the ring of it. Joe was like the perfect, just the absolutely perfect choice for it. And he'd obviously, he'd done Gremlins shortly before, very, very hot director, really dug the script. The intent was just to make it as kind of, as absolutely scary as possible. And then, to the degree that we succeeded, have it a twist at the end. In the Twilight Zone world parlance, it's called a biter bit story, meaning someone who's a biter, throughout most of the story, he gets a bit at the end, kind of hoisted on his own petard, if you will. So, it was that. And, but again, Joe, such a really good filmmaker. And so totally understood what it needed, that he was able to create. It was all in camera, obviously. The Shadow Man, who kind of looks two-dimensional a lot of the time,
Very oddly, yeah.
Yeah, which is wonderful, because it just makes you go, okay, he's not entirely human somehow, all that sort of thing. And that's all totally filmmaking. And Joe was a huge, huge, important. Contributor to that. So, one of my faves.
What's amazing, when you talk about like the sort of twist, because we all got used to it from the original Twilight Zone, is what I particularly liked about this episode is it didn't feel like there was going to be a twist. I think that's rare. Like ordinarily when you see an episode that's going to be predicated on a twist, you can kind of feel it from the opening frame. And that's what I admired about this episode, rewatching it. Like, it doesn't feel like we're going there at all. So, I don't know. I'm just saying kudos to you.
Oh, thank you. That was one of the things I learned from the show. And it was kind of innate, I guess, in what I was doing up until then. Because wordplay does the same thing, but working on the show, it crystallized it for me, which is you can have I have the world's shortest attention span, as evidenced by the sentence I just said, where I just stop in the middle and change direction. But I really have a criminally short attention span, so things that are all set up just waiting for the twist ending are very frustrating to me. I just,
yeah.
It's like, okay, I get it. I get the setup. Just what's going to be the twist? So what I learned from the Twilight Zone experience was try to make the story itself, what the situation, as twist, you know, as compelling and give it escalation as much as possible, so that the story itself is compelling. You know, don't just rest on the laurel that you know you're going to have a twist ending. So in Shadow Man, for example, it's exactly what you're talking about. It's I think there's a real escalation to you know, his discovery of Shadow Man, then how he starts to use him, then how his, you know, his standing with the other kids changes, and the escalation with the community's reaction to the fact that this is going on, all that sort of thing is all kind of baked into it. So that you make a very good point, that which I never realized, that it also helps to disguise the twist as well. So that to me is why, if Shadow Man is, you know, interesting, compelling, whatever, you know, leading up to the twist, as you've said, that's probably the reason why.
The other thing, well, at least another episode I think a lot of people remember just from the visuals alone, was Matter of Minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, now obviously that was based on the Theodore Sturgeon story, right? The yesterday was Monday.
It's not really, it's not the same. If you read the short story, it's,
I have, yeah. It's it feels like more of an original piece than not. I think it even says in the credits "suggested by," which is appropriate. Like in a situation like that, now, did you like read the story and say, "I can do something with this," or was it like handed to you? Or I mean, I know you were just new and on the staff and everything.
Yeah, I think I know. I read the short story, and we knew that it was the short story wasn't going to translate directly. And then I just came up with this notion, and everybody liked it, and so just kind of went for it. And we actually said, you know, suggested by as not to elevate my writing on the episode, but actually to kind of inoculate Sturgeon from, you know, the fact that, you know, what have we done to his short story,
right?
What absolutely cracks me up and drives, so I'll speak for Alan Brenner, but drives crazy, and not unjustifiably, is how online there is actually a contingent of people who consider that, you know, Matter of Minutes, you know, their favorite episode and one of the best episodes. I don't, you know, I mean, I'm obviously gratified, but I smile when I see that, because we had a lot of great episodes. I mean, Alan had Writers Guild, you know, nominated, episodes, and just really quality stuff. But anyway, there's something about the blue people, building humanity's future that seemed to, you know, really kind of, you know, catch people.
So the Uncle Devil Show is the second segment of the 10th episode of Twilight Zone 1985. It is written by Donald Todd, directed by David Steinberg, and focuses on a young child named Joey who gets an interesting VHS tape from his father called Tim Ferritt and Friends, which features a character whose name is Uncle Devil telling children how to do bad things and be bad. It's essentially demonic Mr. Rogers.
That's fair.
It's essentially Soupy Sales.
Yeah, that's true. Go into your parents' wallets and take their money and send it to me.
Exactly. Oh, man, what a cast for this. Joel Polis as the dad. A lot of people would remember him as the guy who owned the jerk store from Seinfeld, or one of the guys from The Thing. I mean, this guy's been
Fuchs.
Kind of stuff. Fuchs, thank you. And then Murphy Dunn as Uncle Devil. Oh, man, what just so good. So many good things. Of course, I mostly remember him as being the leader of Murph and the Murph Tones from the Booze.
Murph and the Magic Tones.
Thank you. Sorry.
Look at you in those candy ass monkey suits.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, great, great stuff. And again, fast and gets the point across. Gives us a little twist. Okay, whatever, but I appreciated it.
Yeah, I liked it as well. I think they hit a little too hard, where they keep sort of overly mentioning that parents need to be supervising their kids. Like, we just needed that line one time. We actually didn't need the line at all. these sort of holier-than-thou parents who are commenting on everyone in their neighborhood, like lack of supervision for their children. Meanwhile, their child is in the next room turning their dog into a four-eyed beast. I love this thing. I wish that they didn't kind of try to give it a twist at the end where everything goes away and then, oh, but there are still cockroaches crawling out of the thing. Was this real or was it not? They could have just gone with what they went with, and I would be completely satisfied with it. Although overall, for like a 6 or 7 minute segment, is that it? Hits hard. I liked it a lot.
I would say that this reminds me the most of Children's Zoo and kind of the length and scope of what it's going for. It's another kind of the children. Like, that's kind of like the children and the parents and the disconnect here. And I liked that a lot. I think it was interesting. And it's just enough to get us to the next segment. And not more, if that makes sense. Like, I don't want any more of this, and I didn't need any more. I think I got just enough.
Yeah, and it didn't feel like just filler in between.
No.
It is a good little story, well told. But, again, don't oversell it. Don't, belabor it and add a whole bunch of other plots that we don't need. Like, when these little interstitial segments come on, they can be either some of the best or some of the worst, and this is one of the better ones.
And Tim Ferriss goes to hell.
I wanted to see some of that.
Yeah, well, this is, yeah, exactly. I just like how the character's name is Uncle Devil and no one picks up on it.
Well, because those parents are not supervising their kids.
They're so oblivious that they don't even see that one has a raptor head and the other has a bird head.
Well, as they say, like Mike said, children, they're oblivious. They don't know any better.
Yeah.
Kids.
Yeah.
Kids and parents. No, it is the children who are wrong. All right, so let's move on to the final segment, opening day.
The perfect crime is the one nobody realizes has been committed. Every day, we commit a dozen perfect crimes in our mind, and we never get punished. Because those crimes never happen. That's the way it is in the real world. But murder, like a bad meal, has a way of repeating, especially when the bloody stroke is struck in the Twilight Zone.
So opening day is directed, like previously mentioned, by John Milius. It is written by Garrett Graham. Yes, that Garrett Graham, for fans of you fans of Phantom of the Paradise out there, you beef fans, that Garrett Graham. And it follows Jeffrey Jones. Oops. yikes. And Martin Cove as two best friends, one of which is cheating on someone's wife. And what happens when they go out hunting on opening duck season day?
I thought it was rabbit season.
Is it rabbit? I thought it was duck. No, it's duck. Oh, Jesus Christ.
No, it's rabbit season.
There is no fear in this duck blind, Mr. Lawrence.
This segment is not good.
I think I want to agree with you on that.
You know what it reminds me of? That the what's that thing
Twilight from the Zone 2000?
Yeah, the swap where the black guy and the white guy get swapped. That's what it reminds me of.
It's like that never ending. We're going to keep playing this thing out forever. And yeah, it's almost exactly the same. I totally was thinking the same thing. Where it's like, okay, in this version, it's Martin Cove as the husband and Jeffrey Jones as the lover. And in this one, it's Jeffrey Jones as the husband and Martin Cove as the lover. And at the heart of everything is Elan Oberon, who is John Milius' wife. And I don't think that she could necessarily act her way out of a paper bag.
No, she's real bad.
You think?
The real star of this episode is the guy running the fog machine.
Yeah, he definitely was getting paid overtime on this.
Wow, man. He had to keep getting more supplies in between takes.
It's nice to see Martin Cove has his stuff going on now, though, in his life, since he's on, the Cobra Kai. Yeah. He's pretty good.
He has stuff going on from 30 years ago.
You know what, man? At least it's not this. I love Martin Cove.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, at least he's not, taking dirty pictures of kids.
I was going to say, at least he's not a literal sex offender.
This is true.
But yet he worked after being classified as a sex offender.
Did he? With who?
No, Jeffrey Jones. Yeah. Jeffrey Jones was on Deadwood, and in the Deadwood movie.
Well, working again with one of his...
Mr. Milius.
Mr. Milius, yeah. And I noticed that the sheriff in this episode, what was that?
Frank McRae.
Frank McRae, yeah. Who I mostly remember from, well, he was in a bunch of Milius stuff, but I remember him mostly from Cannery Row. He's fantastic.
He's real good in that. And yeah, he was also in, 1941? That's a Milius production and co-written. And Used Cars, the Zemeckis thing, which Milius also produced. So he's sort of a big Milius guy. And he's in every movie that Sylvester Stallone has ever made.
Yeah, and which Used Cars, which Garrett Graham was in.
And Garrett Graham, there you go. That is weird, man. And he's the original angry black sergeant or a captain in 48 Hours.
Oh, and then he kind of... Was he parodying his own role in The Last Action Hero?
Yeah, he absolutely was.
Okay.
But this episode... as you can tell, since we have not talked about it almost at all, is really bad. It's not, you know what, I take it back, it's not even really bad. It's just not much of anything. It's very telegraphed from the get-go.
Let's speak forensically for a moment here, where Martin Cove and Jeffrey Jones are out at the duck blind, and then he bludgeons Jeffrey Jones several times with his rifle, then drowns him, and then I guess the police decide that, well, we won't look to see if there are any head wounds here. He just clearly drowned. Like, what?
This is definitely before CSI.
Yeah. And couldn't Martin Cove, like, being as big as he is next to slight Jeffrey Jones, just grabbed him and pulled him into the water and drowned him anyway? Like, was the bludgeoning even necessary? I guess I'm nitpicking in what is an overly bad episode to begin with, but... I don't know. I want to like this episode because I love John Milius. I know he's a right-wing nutter and everything, but for fuck's sake, man, he made Conan the Barbarian, so he's always getting a pass from me.
Oh, yeah, he's kind of the Walter Sochek character from The Big Lebowski.
Right. Yeah. He's one of these right-wing nutters that I kind of miss, actually, though, where he doesn't, he's overly too militaristic, but, like, you know, ultimately a square guy, you know what I mean? Like one of these sort of old conservatives who, like, know when they're beaten and won't do just anything to be on top, which is what we're sort of dealing with the neoconservatives these days. So,
you mean like James Woods?
Yeah, like James Woods.
Yeah, Milius always kind of, it felt like he was taking the piss out of a lot of people just because he was around that, like, kind of post-hippie era, and he was just like, yeah, I'm going to be the guy who talks to you all about military history and tells you about the Greeks and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm hanging out with De Palma and Lucas and all these guys, but I'm going to be, you know, kind of trying to be the big brother of the group and just be that a-hole character.
Yeah, more of a provocateur than necessarily like a, you know, like let's do the worst that we can do because we believe in this sort of right-wing doggerel. Like, that always came across to me too. So, you know, I know he gets a bad rep for being the right-wing guy amongst those other guys, but at the same time, you know what? Like, fucking, when he's working well, he's working well, and, you know, I can appreciate somebody trying to take the piss out of everyone around them.
And again, he directed Conan the Barbarian.
Right. And he had the courage of his convictions when he's doing something like Red Dawn. He's not like, you know, doing that fucking remake where it's like, oh, no, we can't make the Chinese the bad guys. We better, you know, make it.
Because it has to play in China, dude. Come on, Mike. Don't you understand international capitalism? Marvel sure does.
I sure do. I know Tencent
Production.
Tencent
Productions. Boy, if you see Tencent Productions before a movie, you know that there is going to be a Chinese actor in that film who looks completely out of place.
Hell yes. They're the ones that make WeChat. It's basically like if Mark Zuckerberg were a producer of a movie.
Wasn't a movie I just saw recently was a Tencent production.
I think that there was some Tencent movie money. Wasn't there in Once Upon a Time in America? Or sorry, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Is that what it was?
Because of the way that they were so anti-Asian in that film.
Sir, how dare you speak about Bruce Lee in that way? was it that? Oh, something else. No, it was Men in Black International.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, you're
that's
right.
What it is. Yeah, and I was like, I remember thinking to myself when I turned it on, I was like, oh, there's going to be an Asian actor in this movie who is completely out of place.
Yeah, and it's going to be kind of not good for the most part, kind of like The Meg.
Yeah, but at least The Meg.
Well, not as bad as that.
The Meg is mildly entertaining.
Was it?
Yes.
Mildly.
Yeah, Men in Black International was not entertaining at all.
I enjoyed it more than The Meg. I kept waiting for Jason Statham to roundhouse kick that shark in the face, and since that didn't happen, the movie's a big failure.
But yeah, speaking of Chinese characters up the wazoo, my goodness.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, the issue with this, back to this episode, ultimately the issue I have with this episode is that it just...
What episode are we talking about?
Right, yeah. Ultimately, the issue I have with this episode is that it just does nothing. It doesn't have a message like that the racially charged 2002 remake does. That has, and it's like, it's racially charged, but at the same time, it's also not racially over, like, racially overwrought with, like, ham-fisted ways of telling the story. Like, Shame and Guilt is a much better episode, and it does effectively the same thing. Like, walk another mile in another man's shoes type thing.
Yeah, I mean, there is none of that at all. Like, Martin Cove just steps into this guy's shoes and then just kind of starts doing what the other guy did. Like, it doesn't seem like he has any foreknowledge of what's about to happen to him, even though he's... it's really unusual. It just kind of shows up and does its thing and then leaves. And, like, there's no arc to it. Like, no characters learn anything. Like, very unusual.
Which is unfortunate because, again, because the people that are involved in this episode are so kind of good in everything else that they've been in, especially Martin Cove.
I remember what it is. I saw the logo before A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which was before Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Sorry to go but I'm much more interested in 10 Cent Productions than I am in this episode.
In this particular segment?
10 Cent Productions, you know, and it's soon to take over everything.
Garrett Graham and Chris Hubel wrote Children's Zoo.
They sure did.
So it's kind of shocking that what, you know, was so pointed and like lacked any fat and got right to the point, would produce a, you know, what is effectively like a 22-minute segment where it just meanders all over the place without any point at all.
Well, again, maybe they benefited from the shortened, like, maybe they benefited from a shorter segment before, and we just didn't see the problems.
Maybe they wrote that original Children's Zoo as a 22-minute one, and they said, yeah, no, this will not fly, like, cut it all the way down, and maybe they could have done that with this one as well.
Which they should have, because this could have been like a 10-15 minute episode at that.
Yeah.
Wasn't it 20 minutes?
It was long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt long. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, when you look at Uncle Devil and Shadow Man, I mean, Shadow Man was the perfect length, but that can't be very long at all. And then Uncle Devil was so short, and this just feels like it is the big sponge that just sucked up all the air and the time from this episode.
Here's how good Shadow Man is. I'll still recommend this episode.
Oh, I would completely agree. I mean, this episode with just the two segments, even though the third segment's not great, is good enough that I kind of overlook how bad opening day is. And opening day, again, like, on paper, it sounds interesting, but once you kind of get into the meat of it, it's really disappointing, with or without the fact that Jeffrey Jones is in it.
I'm wondering, was there a commercial break in the middle of this episode as well, the segment?
I'm pretty sure there was.
There have to have been.
Yeah, that would have just belabored the point.
Right? Oh, my God. Just, it won't end. Make it stop. Anything else?
I'm good.
Yeah, that's his, just don't watch this segment, I guess.
10 Cent Productions, brought to you by bringing you Dreams for Sale, the podcast. Now with our new co-host, Ji Ling.
Yeah.
hello, Master Premier Winnie the Pooh. Oh, jeez. So on the next episode of Dreams for Sale, we're going to be talking about episode 11 of the 1985 reboot. That episode is broken into two segments, The Beacon and One Life Furnished in Early Poverty. One has Peter Reigert in it.
I met him once outside a movie theater, and I accidentally referred to him as Otter and not Boone, and it bothers me to this day.
Boone, we're the only white people in here. Oh boy, you know, he probably thinks about that every day. He's like, this one fuck referred to me as Tim fucking Matheson's character. You piece of shit.
Well, at least Tim Matheson is not a right wing piece of shit.
Is Peter Reigert?
Yeah.
No, Tim Matheson. I see that all over his Facebook. He's very like, what the fuck is going on in the world?
I mean, most people are like that. Yeah. It's just varying degrees of that. Take your pick.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Until then, where can people find you, Mike White?
You can find me talking about Kolchak the Night Stalker over at thekolchaktapes.com, where I'm joined by you, Chris. I'm not sure if you're aware that I'm actually recording those conversations when we talk about Carl Kolchak But I have been, and I've created a whole show out of those conversations. So, surprise!
Even the ones where we talk about things we maybe shouldn't around other people?
You're talking about, like, the slash fiction things, those stories?
Star Trek, the original series slash fiction that we're writing, yes.
Yes. All of that is there.
Wow.
So Mr. Spock with Karl Kolchak.
And Gorn.
Intense.
Yes. And the Mugatu. Let's just say we're into some freaky shit.
Yeah, it gets pretty wild over there, so highly recommend it. And I do some other stuff, but it's not important.
What about you, Father Malone?
I do some very important stuff on my YouTube channel.
Well, even you couldn't get through that by yourself, huh?
Yeah, no. Yeah, I got a show called You've Never Seen. You should check that out. You should also listen to Chronicles from the Crypt, where I talk with Chris here about Tales from the Crypt and, other shit. I'm sure you can find us.
Yeah, and you can find me on the CultureCast sometimes with one of these two guys talking about movies. If you're into movies, cool. If not, hey, it's not for you. And I also do a podcast called The One Season Show, where we talk about TV shows that only lasted one season with a friend of mine, Jess Byard. Big thanks, as always, to Roxy Drive and Neutron Dreams for the music for Dreams for Sale, and we'll catch you on the next episode.